This week, the markets took a breather amid typical summer doldrum conditions. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you for a big encore show. We've got an all-star cast lined up for you this week with Eric Sprott from Sprott Asset Management, James Turk of GoldMoney.com, Dr. Stephen Lieb, and CEO Brendan Cahill. Next week, Robert Ian and I will return with an all-new show. We want you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. It's a pleasure to welcome James Turk back to the show, the founder of GoldMoney.com and co-author of The Money Bubble, a new bestseller. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thanks, Chris. It's always great to speak with you.
Let's begin today, if we could, with a story I think that bodes well for the precious metals sector. You know, the Reserve Bank of India has agreed to allow five of its major banks to import gold without penalties. I'm sure listeners know by now there were some curbs that significantly stemmed the inflow, if you will, of gold across their borders. Put some downward pressure on global demand. Premiums that were soaring are now collapsing by as much as 70%. We've seen them drop back down to more normal levels. Do you agree that this new surge in demand could help put a solid floor under the gold price?
Yeah, of course. I mean, India has always consistently been one of the largest buyers of gold. And, you know, they do that in order to protect themselves against the depreciation of the Indian rupee, which has been one of the world's weakest currencies for decades. So the price of gold in terms of the Indian rupee continues to rise. In other words, Chris, you know, gold is an important form of savings in India. It will continue to be that way for, you know, the foreseeable future. So it is a big factor on the gold market, and just another reason to be bullish about gold.
No, I think so. I mean, it certainly can't hurt that the former number one importing nation for the yellow metal is, now firing on all eight cylinders. Well, it'll be interesting to see if India remains in the number two position or if they reclaim their former first place position on gold. You've also commented recently on backwardation, and this is an interesting story. It essentially shows disequilibrium between expectations for gold price, actually for gold in the future. And I wonder if you could tell folks more about why you think this is so significant and how it might send the metals higher.
Yeah, you know, it really comes down to interest rates, and that's what is involved in terms of all currency exchange rates. The higher the interest rate, the weaker the currency. The market basically requires a high interest rate if a currency is more prone to inflation than another currency. So, for example, the Indian rupee has a much higher interest rate than, say, the euro, for the reason that the Indian rupee is likely to be inflated away more so than the euro. And of all of the various monies out there, gold has the lowest interest rate. And what that basically means is that gold has less risk than from inflation or debasement or from central bank actions than any national currency. So normally, you know, that means that gold's spot price is lower than its future price. It's basically a mathematical equation in terms of the way currencies interact and exchange with one another. But occasionally, and very, very rarely, actually, you know, gold might go into what's called backwardation, where the spot price is higher than the future price. And it really shouldn't happen in theory. It happened in 1999 for a couple of days when gold was at an abnormally low level. It happened in 2008 at the, you know, financial crisis when everything was sold, including gold, and that drove gold down to an abnormally low level for 3 days. It was in backwardation. But over the past several months, gold's been in backwardation 60% of the time. We're talking about, you know, like 90 days of backwardation over the past 180 days or so, which is just, unbelievable that it's happened. And what that essentially means is that just like gold was at an abnormally low level in 1999 and 2008, it is again at an abnormally low level. But compared to the prior two periods, central banks have been intervening in the gold market to keep the gold price as low as it is. So it represents, in my view, a great opportunity to follow the strategy that I've been talking about for years, where, you know, you just continue to dollar cost average by accumulating, you know, gold or accumulating silver, because it's a way of saving money. It's just the logic is the same as why the Indians buy gold as a form of savings. You know, the whole world should view gold as a form of money and accumulating it over long periods of time as a way of saving money.
No, I think it's well said. I mean, it ultimately is money, whereas fiat currencies are, well, essentially worthless. And I think you do an excellent job there. They're fiat. They're based on faith. This is really the first time in history where that is the case. And so I guess that's a good segue into The Money Bubble, your bestseller, What to Do Before the Bubble Pops. And you tell, I think, an interesting tale about a testimony before Congress with J.P. Morgan in 1912, interestingly and strategically, 1 year before our Federal Reserve was established. You say that this top financier of ours declared that money is gold and nothing else. What an interesting thing to hear from arguably one of the founders of the Federal Reserve. Any comments?
Yeah, you know, back in 1912, when Morgan, J.P. Morgan, gave that testimony before Congress, you know, everybody understood that money was gold. Today, you know, people don't understand that concept. And, you know, getting back to your point about national currencies, which are fiat currencies based on nothing but promises and they're not redeemable into metal, the whole key of the money bubble is that today what people think of as money is not really money in its historical and traditional and true sense. It's a money substitute circulating in place of money. So national currencies are just temporarily filling the gap while we go allow this money bubble to expand. The real money is what J.P. Morgan declared back in 1912 in testimony. Money is gold and nothing else. But we're allowing all of these money substitutes to circulate in place of money. And what this has created is a lot of abnormal conditions in the market. And that's the bubble itself is, you know, we know what a bubble is. We saw it with the dot-com bubble. You know, everybody during the dot-com bubble said that profits don't matter, only market share does. And, you know, after that bubble popped, we realized how that particular conventional wisdom at the time, or during the real estate bubble, you know, everybody said that housing prices only go up, and we all know now that so the conventional wisdom during the housing bubble was wrong. And the same thing with the money bubble. Everybody says that national currencies are money, but they're not. They're only a money substitute circulating in place of money. And when this bubble pops, we'll realize how silly it was to think that a national currency, in fact, is a form of money, because it doesn't actually extinguish a trade. It just is someone else's debt, and this, whether it's a bank or a central bank. And that ultimately distinguishes fiat currency from true money, which is a tangible asset, gold or silver.
You might recall that the former Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, noted that he didn't buy the premise that housing prices could decline, that they had never declined in history. I wonder if he'd ever read any of Professor Shiller at Yale's work, which shows the housing market existed before 1950. There had never really been anything like the bubble we were experiencing over the last 75 years before the housing bubble imploded. There was not a single, even 1% decline in an annual nationwide home price index. So it really was quite the bubble. But there's another bubble on the horizon that folks are looking at or calling for, and that involves debt. And we're hearing of this bond bubble. I wonder how that might factor into your analysis on a forward basis with regard to the precious metals if this new bubble, debt bubble, implodes.
Yeah, that's the key element of the money bubble. And there is a lot of debt today. In fact, there's more debt in the world than there was back in 2007 at the peak of the last bubble before the 2008 collapse. And the sad or tragic thing is, Chris, that none of the problems that appeared in 2008 have been solved. You know, banks are still terribly illiquid. We still have too much debt that cannot be serviced, even at these artificially low interest rates. You know, the debt cannot be serviced. And then they continue to pile on more debt and more debt instead of recognizing that the system itself is at fault and that things need to change. We have to go back to what we had prior to 1971 when national currencies were still at least nominally tied in some way to gold, because unless you have that anchor, you don't have the discipline on governments and their ability to spend. And they just keep printing and printing and printing until ultimately the currency is destroyed. And that's the whole key behind the book, The Money Bubble, And then, of course, the subtitle, What to Do Before It Pops. We basically go through various strategies explaining how people can protect their portfolios from a collapse of the money bubble.
You also say that gold is at the center of all commerce because it is the most liquid, tangible asset in the global economy. I mean, this just makes sense. I mean, look at the central banks. What are the top money financiers worldwide and our governments? How do they transact financially? And for the most part, they keep huge stockpiles of gold on reserves. I mean, we hear that the United States has something like 10,000 tons. So it would seem as though if you really want to understand what money is, you should look at the folks who make it their business.
Yeah, you know, another way of looking at it is, you know, gold has been money for 5,000 years at the center of commerce. It's only since 1971 when the governments have tried to relegate gold to the sidelines. But gold really hasn't been relegated to the sidelines, and the only reason why the gold price has risen since 1971 or even before is because central banks continue to destroy the purchasing power of currencies. So, you know, again, if you have that historical perspective, it makes it much easier to understand that we are indeed in a money bubble. And we don't know when the bubble's going to pop, just like we didn't know when the dot-com bubble was going to pop or the real estate bubble was going to pop. But you know intuitively, and also you know from just studying and looking at history and thinking about it logically, that you do know the bubble is going to pop at some point in time.
And I wonder if we could also address the fact that we're not receiving much fiscal stimulus. You know, the Federal Reserve was essentially shouldering much of the burden trying to revive the economy. I'd like to know if you think that this could have an impact on their tapering expectations over the last three meetings, I think it is, unless I'm behind one here. They have dropped by about $10 billion at each FOMC meeting the stimulus from the monthly program there. And I'd like to know how you think this could impact the markets going forward. Or is this news, is this story already baked into the market?
Yeah, I think it is already baked into the market. And you know, what they're doing is really very small amount relative to how much they're actually printing. So, you know, I think it was done for, you know, basically propaganda purposes to make the market believe that they're going to go all the way back to where they were in 2007 and reducing the central bank's balance sheet. That's not going to happen. You know, for 100 years since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, pretty much year in and year out, there have been monetary issues one sort or another. The major one is that the dollar continually loses purchasing power, and that's particularly true over the last, you know, over my lifetime, over 6.5 decades, and that's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And you know, people have to adjust to that. They have to recognize it and adjust to that by taking those steps to protect themselves so that come what may, they and their families are protected.
I'd like to return to the money bubble. I think what you are calling for is a worldwide implosion of our financial markets. And, you know, I mean, you two were certainly right on the money over a decade ago when you were calling for the gold market to climb. I wonder if you could hit on some of the bullet points from the money bubble and give people a digestible version, synopsis of just how this might come to pass.
Yeah, you know, back in 2004 when we came out with our first book, The Collapse of the Dollar, we had a couple of key themes. As you mentioned, we were saying people should be buying gold. We also said to bet against the housing bubble. But another theme of that was that ultimately the dollar would collapse. And when 2008 came along, we thought, okay, well, you know, that's going to be the collapse of the dollar. And it was for a period of time. You know, after Lehman went under, there was, you know, the outlook looked pretty bleak, but with all of those various money printing and schemes that central banks brought into play, they managed to pump up the bubble one more time and keep it going. And what we've done now in the money bubble is basically re-evaluated all of the basic analysis that we've put in the collapse of the dollar, added a lot of new analysis to that, and took this big picture point of view as to, okay, how's it going to be playing out over the next several years? And then the key, of course, you know, Chris, is, you know, what things people can do to protect themselves from any type of monetary problems. Because there is going to be a repeat of 2008. There are going to be more crises. You know, In a monetary system which is based on fiat currency, problems with the money are inevitable, and that's what we're seeing now in terms of all of these excesses and balances in the various markets today.
An apt metaphor would be the Federal Reserve chair is just running from one hole in the dam to another, patching the concrete on this side and some makeshift remedy on the other. But eventually, the whole thing has to implode. You know, we really just haven't seen, I think, the issues that brought us to 2008. They never addressed the root causes. You know, they're treating the symptoms, but not the disease. I mean, we haven't returned to anything like the Glass-Steagall Act. I mean, we haven't resolved that problem. The Frank Dodd Act, I think, has done little to help keep history from repeating here.
Governments are going to continue trying to borrow. They're going to continue to try printing money. And history shows that that combination means that it gives politicians the illusion that they can spend ad infinitum. But the reality is that governments, corporations, individuals all have a limited capacity as to how much money they can spend, how much money they can borrow. And governments are going to come to understand that they cannot borrow to infinity because ultimately the currency gets destroyed. And that, sadly, is the way we're headed.
Do you think that ultimately they realize there will be a day of reckoning, or are they so mired in this neo-Keynesian concept that if you print enough money, if you provide enough stimulus, everything will right itself? The ship will come back up. It will not capsize, and the economy will just keep moving forward.
Well, if they were believing that, then they should look at what's happened over the last 6 years since 2008. They've printed trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, and we have less people employed in the United States today than we did back in 2007. So, you know, if this formula supposedly works, print money and it solves all problems, why haven't the problems that we saw in 2008 been solved? Why is unemployment still quite high? Why are there few people working in the country today than there were in 2007? I think what the officials are doing, first of all, I think there's an absence of leadership and willingness to make those changes that are necessary. And what's happened as a consequence, they just don't want the ship of state to go down during their watch. And I think that's what the name of the game has become. Try to keep this bubble floated.
Once Pandora's box is open, there's a sea change. I mean, ultimately, start those incentives and people receive the entitlements. The people begin to realize that they can demand money, and the printing presses, they just never stop after that. Do you want to tell folks more about the money bubble and what's going on at goldmoney.com, please?
The money bubble is available from Amazon, or you can also order it through your local bookstore. And if you're interested in looking at gold and silver as a way of diversifying your portfolio, I'm the founder of Gold Money, or goldmoney.com. And what we do is we enable people to buy gold and silver online and have that stored for them in 5 different countries around the world.
Very good. Well, we want to thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, it's a pleasure to have Dr. Stephen Leeb back on the show. The latest of his 7 bestsellers includes Red Alert.
That's true.
Well, I understand the weather in New York today is actually improving. It's getting a bit warmer on the East Coast.
Weather in New York is beautiful.
I thought we could begin the dialogue today, if we could, with the precious metals market. It's our listeners' favorite. Now, after recording one of the most impressive rallies in years, the metals have cooled off in the past few weeks. And what I find interesting is that the U.S. dollar, though, well, it's missed every opportunity that it's had to move sharply higher. Why do you think the greenback is having trouble finding momentum here? And what could that mean for the commodities, the CRB index, and the precious metals?
Well, I actually think that one signal for the metals and precious metals in particular to rally will probably be more aggressive steps taken by the European Union to get their economies going. And then I do think you'll see a dollar rally, and I think you'll probably see gold rally on the back of that dollar, believe it or not. I mean, I think the dollar-gold connection is, somewhat overrated. It may work out almost the opposite this time around. in which you have a relatively strong dollar and strong gold at the same time. And the reason being, once the Europeans start, aggressively easing monetary policy, you're going to get a lot of growth. And I think you're going to stimulate a lot of demand for commodities. If you go back, Chris, to the commodity charts, you find that most, or at least a lot of the indices, it really didn't make peaks in 2008, but they made peaks in 2011. And that was almost to the month when the European countries went into a funk. They had six consecutive quarters of negative growth, and commodities came down. And the Eurozone is the world's most important and largest economic bloc. I think that what's happened in the Ukraine is kind of a sidebar to the implications. And, you know, one of many, many implications is that the European Central Bank has to be very, very careful that these peripheral countries, maintain strong growth, or else, you know, they could drift eastward themselves, especially the Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. They have to be very, very careful, and I think that's really been a sort of set a fire under them to start stimulating their own economies, and I think you'll see metals lift with that. Precious metals in particular. I mean, they tend to, you know, follow commodities. And eventually, as is always the case, you probably have a little bit too much of a good thing. And I think that that will lead to, you know, a major rally in gold.
You've made that interesting correlation with the euro. You said something to the effect that, you know, we're looking at about a half a billion people there as opposed to the United States, roughly 300 million. I mean, it truly is an economic engine to be contended with. So we're thinking of China, looking at them for all the growth, but we can't ignore Europe.
No, you can't. And, you know, per capita income, et cetera, Europe is a considerably larger economy than China. And, you know, when it goes into a funk, I mean, it really was, you know, kind of a historic post-war funk, six consecutive quarters of decline. It's going to take its toll. And it certainly has taken its toll. But, I mean, you know, over the past few weeks when you've heard talk of a more aggressive monetary stance among the European countries, especially the Bundesbank going along with quantitative easing, I mean, that's like cows recommending steak for dinner. It's a strong sign that they mean business. They really know that they've got to go after economic growth, or else they could face very, very serious consequences.
And I wonder if you might address one of your recent calls for the yellow metal of $2,000 to $2,500, that we could actually see, at least on a nominal basis, higher levels with gold. I mean, we've really experienced quite a reaction here, and it seems like we've put in a floor, at least for the time being. You expect the typical forces that were in play back in the early 2000s to support the precious metals here, and then a resurgence of economic growth in Europe. Are you concerned at all about some sluggish economic reports coming from China?
No, I'm not really that concerned. I mean, obviously, you know, you've got an economy as large and complex as China. There are going to be a lot of cross currents there, especially as they kind of transition from a export-driven to a consumer-driven economy. But they have massive infrastructure spending ahead of them that's going to make a lot of sense for them to do, especially in terms of building up a energy infrastructure that I think they want to build, and they would hope will last them for the next 100 years. I think they're well ahead of us and well ahead of almost everybody else in terms of doing that, with the possible exception of Germany. I mean, they've also done a lot of work in building renewable energies, et cetera. But China, I mean, they're going to be spending, I mean, north of $1 trillion over the next 4, 5, 6 years. Well north of $1 trillion, putting up a smart grid and putting in renewable energies and getting set for this century. And that, I think, will sustain growth in that country for a long time to come.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this trend we've seen in China regarding physical gold. You know, we've had quite a shift from a prohibition on gold ownership to overtly encouraging ownership. You've gone on record recently saying that officials are laying the groundwork potentially for a gold-backed currency. Any comments?
Yeah, I think for sure. I think that, you know, right now, you know, I think the dynamics in the world, the economic dynamics in the world are really shifting, and they're shifting east, you know, probably away from our country and much, much more toward China, Russia to some extent, and Germany. You know, what was kind of lost in this recent, you know, Ukraine disaster or whatever, I mean, you know, don't want to say anything good about Putin because there's nothing really good to say about him. But, you know, nevertheless, he's, you know, taken advantage of certain economic levers that he has. And, you know, one of them is that his railway, he and Germany's railway, their partners, basically transport a lot of goods between Germany and China. And the amount of goods are increasing and increasing rapidly. And, you know, this is a very, very big block. I mean, China, Russia, Germany, et cetera. And you consider their proximity to the Middle East. There are a lot of edges that they have. And I think that they, you know, eventually envision a day in which there will be a basket of currencies. And it will include or have, quite a bit of gold in it. And not too many dollars. And I think that that's basically the way the world is shifting at this point. I think, you know, I don't know how many years down the road, but a few maybe. I don't think you'll see oil priced in dollars anymore. I think you'll see it priced in terms of a basket of currencies, of which, you know, gold will certainly, and gold, and the yuan. And I think some of these currencies, you know, I don't know whether it'll follow Bretton Woods exactly, but, I mean, some of these currencies might be directly convertible into gold, like the yuan, like even maybe the German mark standing alone. I don't know. I mean, I have no idea exactly how it plays out, but it does seem the world is shifting from west to east. You will have a new standard, a new type of world currency, and the dollar will play a very small role, or a much, much, much smaller role in that than it does today.
It's interesting. And, you know, we've seen quite a bit of support under West Texas Intermediate crude in recent years and even recently. It's interesting to note that it has essentially treaded water in a very broad consolidation now for, it seems like, almost 5 years. It looks as though the crude oil market is waiting for some impetus to send it substantially higher. Do you concur or do you see something else happening there?
I do concur. I think oil prices could go dramatically higher. But I don't know whether it's going to happen in 3 months or 30 months. But I think that the U.S. has made, I think, really a fatal bet on fracking. And it's, you know, it could last another, you know, couple of years. I mean, we could continue to increase oil production, but then it stops. I mean, there's only so much productivity you can get out of every rig. Once that productivity starts leveling off, you just need more and more rigs because the decline rates are so, so high that it just doesn't become feasible. It doesn't become cost-effective. In fact, you know, you can always get oil out of the ground, but it may start costing, you know, $150, $200, who knows how much. And that will be a very bad sign. And that could be not only a reason for oil to go a lot higher, but that could be the catalyst that causes us to shift off the dollar as a way of pricing oil. I mean, that I think would be very, very important. I mean, this country has really, I think, almost bet the farm on, you know, energy independence vis-a-vis fracking. And I just don't see that working out. I hope I'm dead wrong on this, incidentally. I hope I'm completely wrong on it. But I just, you know, I fear, because I think that the logic behind it just doesn't suggest a long-term solution for this at all. Doesn't suggest it is a long-term solution to our energy problems or our energy needs. It just doesn't. So I think that's what I would keep an eye on, and I think that probably will be the most important catalyst that you'll see over the next several years, decline in production rates of oil in this country. Now, again, I can't say whether that's going to happen, start happening in 3 or 6 or 30 months, but it will happen in the not-too-distant future.
That is certainly not good news for the United States, but it's, I guess, music to the ears of fans of photovoltaics. What an interesting tie-in, because I know you're a huge fan, as am I. We've discussed in the past many times solar panels and their amazing qualities and the way that they've increased efficiency in recent years. And we've also talked about the fact that just a 100-watt solar panel can require up to 1 ounce of silver to manufacture. What a hot sector. You know, at one point in recent months, solar-related companies, First Solar and others, were the hottest sector. I think I read somewhere at bigcharts.com that there was nearly a 1,000% increase.
Solar is growing very rapidly, and, you know, some of the manufacturers of photovoltaics are growing, too, are doing very, very well in the market, like Giga Solar, which is a Taiwanese company that I follow. And silver itself, though, has been kind of dead in the water, which I just find, I'd be very, very honest, I find it very puzzling. I don't like to, you know, talk about conspiracy or you know, things being held down, et cetera. But if I were to bet that there was something going on in one particular market right now, it would probably be silver. I have no idea why it's still trading near $20. I mean, I honestly think it should be closer to 35, 40, 50, 60. Much, much higher prices. You know, there have been these rumors in the silver market for years and years that it's being manipulated. I don't place that much credence in it, but it certainly seems odd in the face of, you know, the performance of stocks, again, like Giga Solar. I mean, unfortunately, you can't buy it in this country. You have to, you know, you have to be able to speak, I guess it is, what, Mandarin or Cantonese and live in Taiwan. But you know, if you look at it, it's certainly belies a dead silver market. I mean, it really is a stock dedicated to photovoltaics and silver paste in particular, and the stock has gone gangbusters. And its earnings have gone gangbusters. And historically, silver had followed this stock pretty faithfully, and it kind of stopped. So it sort of, in fact, I'm just punching up the stock now, Chris. And, you know, it stock has gone from, 300 to 700 in the year to date. Yeah. And, you know, you see things that are like, you know, pretty obvious. I mean, just, you know, quoting the description of the company, Giga Solar Materials manufactures solar conductive paste to provide solar energy. So it's difficult to connect the dots when you see a company, you know, which is fairly substantial, way up, you know, doubling in not too long a period of time. Yet what they're, you know, relying on as raw product, you know, basically just staying, you know, fit and just staying, you know, just sitting still. I think silver will have its day. That's the bottom line. And I think when it does, it'll be explosive. It really, really will take off. It'll be a, you know, gangbusters. Now, you know, one reason could be copper. Copper's kind of been a laggard and might be a laggard this year because, there's a little bit of excess copper production, and that might run into 2016 or so. But I just don't see any excess silver production at all, and I have no reason. I just don't have an explanation.
The problem might lead to the solution. The very fact that people are relegating silver to the industrial metal category could bode well for its future prospect.
Yeah, no, it absolutely could. And like I said, these things tend to straighten themselves out. And I think you will have you'll have a massive rally in silver. I really do.
One of my picks, First Solar, recommended it right around 35 to 37. It's a horse race. You're a nose ahead of me here. 37, and it's about 73 now, so probably not quite 100% that you have. But you know what? I think this company, FSLR, is on the verge of a breakout. Please, folks, don't take that as a recommendation. It's just a fantastic company. Great fundamentals. Financials are really sound. and the technicals are great. I want to see this company north of 100, something to put on people's radar screen. Also wanted to ask you about the rare earth elements. This is another area that you've been watching closely, one of the few people to do so. I want to give the listeners an idea of just how essential these are. I mean, it's in virtually just like silver, but we see it in everything from hard drives on your desktop and your laptop. If you ever need a rare earth magnet, you have some of those outdated hard drives sitting around, crack one open, you'll have a wonderfully powerful magnet for free. Wind turbines, and hydraulic turbines. So these are very hot, just like solar panels. You need rare earths to produce high quality turbines.
I think that what you say is absolutely true. Basically, I guess from the 50s on, every decade you saw a quantum leap in permanent magnets and their power. And then all that stopped with the advent of rare earths around mid-1980s, and we really haven't made any real progress in developing stronger magnets since, I don't know, mid-late 1980s. And even the research that you see today on some of the nanotechnologies still focus on rare earths, because it's rare earths that have been at the center of high-level magnetism and permanent magnets. And there's a lot you cannot do without permanent magnets, and you name some of them. A lot of electronic equipment relies on them. A lot of very advanced defense equipment relies on rare earths. Right now, we don't have any real of the important rare earths. We don't have, we basically don't have any supply. I mean, we have one major rare earth company that's operating, that's Molycorp, but they don't produce the kind of rare earths you need for magnets, which are the heavy rare earths. And we don't have the supply chain from getting the ore out of the ground, rare earth ore out of the ground, to actually producing a permanent magnet. I mean, there's probably 6 to 10 steps in that chain. And the only country that, you know, really can do it right now is China. I mean, not only are they the biggest supplier of rare earth ore, they are also the only country that has an absolute soup-to-nuts supply chain for producing rare earths. It's another, you know, area where we've really got to get on our horse and start moving fast. There are other rare earth deposits out there, heavy rare earth deposits, but the point is that there hasn't been any real effort to put up, you know, the other parts of the supply chain you're going to need in order to get from those rare earths to those heavy rare earths to permanent magnets. I mean, that's a very, very technical, refined process, and it takes a lot of education, a lot of technique. And we don't produce the engineers in this country right now, at least we're not producing them, that have that capability. And, you know, that's why, you know, Molycorp has to ship their ore off to China in order to have it processed. And if these other companies like Ucore, et cetera, which we've talked about and recommended them, that they've done very, very well, but they're also going to need access to all these other processing, refining, separation. I mean, all the things that go into, you know, getting heavy rare earths, they don't have it. They may rely on China, too, which is, it's just not a good position to be in. I mean, we actually, we should be in a position where we really control our own fate, especially in an area as vital as this. And, you know, the irony here, Chris, is that, you know, the new technologies that you see surrounding rare earths and the efforts to come up with other forms of permanent magnets rely on rare earths. And, you know, you use nanotechnologies, okay, that's fine. But, you know, what percent of the weight of the magnet are there? What percent of the nanoparticles are rare earth? And a lot. I mean, there just doesn't appear to be any way around our need for these heavy rare earths. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's a hopeless situation, but it's something that just doesn't seem to be on our radar screen right now, and we should put it there very, very high up.
Agreed. And I hope that some sharp listener comes up with a way, devises a method for recycling rare earths, because they're becoming, you know, much more prevalent in our items today.
They really are. And I think anything we can do to improve or facilitate their availability would just be great. It would just be doing this country a tremendous service.
A possible way to benefit your country as well as profit for your family as well. So
absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Everybody wins. Well, as we wrap up today, is there anything else on your radar screen that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I would keep a very careful eye on what's going on with the Iranian nuclear talks. I think they're, you know, more than important right now. I think that there has been a sense is that Saudi Arabia is very upset with the United States, and I think that that's a major concern. It really is. And I think that we have to be extremely careful how we handle these talks. I think we have to be extremely careful what role Russia is going to start playing in the world. And we have to continue to remind ourselves that Russia and China are neighbors. They have like $500 billion energy pact right now. That's a lot of money. They have a lot of mutual interests in common. Those mutual interests really don't include us other than as a peripheral player. So, yeah, there's a lot to watch. There really is right now an awful lot to watch. I do think that we have to watch what's going on in the East and the Middle East. It's going to be very, very easy to lose control of these situations. I really do. I mean, I can envision, I'm not saying I'm predicting this, but I certainly can envision a situation in which Iran has control of the, not control, but has basic control over the Iranian nuclear facilities. By virtue of that, has a lot of sway over in Saudi Arabia, and Russia does. I mean, Russia has control over Iranian nuclear facilities, which gives them a lot of sway in Saudi Arabia, China a lot of sway in Saudi Arabia. These are the kind of dynamics that make for a change in reserve currency status. I mean, all the Saudis have to do, I mean, despite everything that we've seen, is say that they want to price their oil in something other than dollars, and then the world shifts. It's like a, you know, like an earthquake, and a monetary earthquake, and that could happen. And it's, you know, I really would keep your eye on the headlines on the front pages as well as what you see on the internet on the financial pages. It's a German alliance too. I mean, you know, what struck me. And I did write a little bit about it, was when, you know, the Ukraine thing first broke out, the president of China, Xi, had paid a visit to Germany, and he was in Duisburg, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but, you know, that's a city that houses the largest land-based port in the world. And the reason he was visiting there, trains from that port make a 6,800-mile journey three times a week, delivering goods back and forth between Germany and China. And they hope to, you know, that was once a week a couple of years ago. Now it's three times a week, and they hope to raise it to seven times a week, once a day. And a lot of growth is dependent on these trains, and these trains are controlled by Russian railways in conjunction with German railways. So, I mean, Russia is already a critical cog in the whole German economy. We don't know this. I mean, we're not conscious of this. I mean, you know, it was almost laughable to hear Merkel rebuke Putin. I mean, there's absolutely nothing she can do about it. Nothing. I mean, these alliances are coming together right in front of our noses, and we're just sort of like shrugging our shoulders.
Dr. Lieb, we appreciate that massive database you call a brain. I'm going to look forward to having you back on the show. I hope that you're feeling better, and very kind of you to take time from your busy schedule for us today.
No, appreciate it, Chris. I always do. I always like talking to you. Okay, bye-bye.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The canary in the coal mine is beginning to sing louder and louder. But just like before, when this precious little bird sings, is anyone really listening? And moreover, is anyone making preparations to act? Family Dollar stores, which caters to lower-income shoppers, many who live paycheck to paycheck, recently reported that sales at stores open for more than a year had fallen 3.8% in the quarter that ended March 1st. It also anticipates sales to decline this quarter as well. As a result, the company is cutting prices, jobs, and closing hundreds of stores. Family Dollar's chief executive officer, Howard Levine, on a conference call with investors, pointed to a more financially constrained consumer, which is code for what Walmart said a few weeks ago when it announced a sharp cut in food stamp benefits and higher payroll taxes had, quote, pinched its customers. So is the economy really getting any better when those that cater to the lowest on the economic ladder continue to struggle with declining sales and less traffic in their stores? Clearly, there is still a very large part of the economy where price matters, and it matters a lot. People are selling stuff on Craigslist just to make ends meet. Local shop owners are downsizing again to try and maintain some semblance of reasonable overhead as local taxes, cost of goods, and especially the cost of maintaining employees continues to escalate. If lower-income individuals are being squeezed now, wait until natural gas prices skyrocket in both the U.S. and Europe as a result of the Russian, Crimean, Ukrainian tensions and the global posturing that is resulting. Other military conflicts have centered around oil. The next will include a natural gas component. As energy prices continue to rise, the consumer will continue to get squeezed. Round and round she goes, and where she stops, we always know. Planned conflict, higher energy prices, inflation, and an elongated treadmill on a slope to a declining standard of living for more and more people the world over. That's just the way life is. But you can do something about it. At least for yourself, your family, and maybe a few close friends. Beyond that, the world is on its own. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Well, my featured guest today says that gold will be the trade of the year. Peter Schiff is President and Chief Global Strategist of Euro-Pacific Capital and best-selling author. Welcome back, Peter Schiff.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, you know, in a recent article, you take the mainline press to task over their assessment of inflation versus deflation. You say that the powers that be have it all wrong. Inflation is the cause of all kinds of trouble in our economy. High prices are only a symptom of the inflation. It's not the cause, though. Could you please tell folks what's behind these higher prices, that it's more than likely monetary expansion?
Not everybody is blaming everything on the weather these days, and the problem is it's raining money, right? That is the problem with the weather. But, you know, the government is trying to launch a campaign, a fear campaign about deflation or lowflation. The government is trying to convince us that rising prices are necessary for prosperity, that rising prices stimulate consumption, they stimulate demand. As a result, they lead to hiring and economic growth, and that if prices aren't rising, that the economies are going to implode. And the theoretical explanation for that is people won't spend if they don't think prices are going to go up, that they'll just postpone their purchases. But if they think prices are going to go up, then everybody will rush out to spend before the price hikes, and all that extra spending is what's going to grow the economy. And it is utter nonsense. There is nothing to fear from stable prices. There's nothing to fear from falling prices. In fact, falling prices are the byproduct of a healthy, growing economy. That's what healthy, growing economies produce, is lower prices. Because as you increase production, you increase the supply of goods. You find more innovative ways to produce goods so that the price of the goods can come down. And it's falling prices that leads to higher living standards. Because what makes products affordable is prices going down. The reason that people are poor is because they can't afford to buy the things that they want or the things that they need. Well, the way you alleviate poverty is to bring prices down. And when prices come down, people can afford things. And now they have a better standard of living. And so the history of America, if you study 19th century America, the history is falling prices. That's the secret to our success, is that capitalism brought prices down. And even in this century, you can see pockets of falling prices in consumer electronics. Why do we all have cell phones? Why are they so ubiquitous now in our society? Why does my 11-year-old have an iPhone? Because the price came down.
You recall Gordon Gekko's mobile phone was, all the rage back in, 1988?
The fact that Gordon Gekko had one, it was a novelty. It was a toy for the rich. You had to be Gordon Gekko to afford one. That was the point. Now, according to the government, it would have been better if the price of cell phones went up, if Gordon Gekko's phone was the cheapest and they just got more expensive. No! This is, the government is trying to convince us to fear falling prices because they want rising prices. So they might as well get us to enjoy what they're about to do to us, right? They want, it's like trying to make the bitter tasting medicine go down. That the government wants us to be excited about inflation. The government wants us to think that they've done us a favor by sparing us the pain associated with prices going down. So that when prices go up, will be relieved. And they can say, this is great news. The cost of living is going up. This is great. Good job, Federal Reserve.
Well, no, exactly, because they've convinced us that by owning a debt check, okay, then we've taken on a huge amount of debt and mortgages and all the rest of it and filled the house with devices and furniture that we didn't even pay for. Half of that's on credit.
It's kind of like, almost like, you know that book, Fahrenheit 451, where the firemen, remember, the firemen were there to, they were there to start fires, right? And they're saying, didn't firemen used to put out fires? It's kind of like the Federal Reserve now, now they're trying to create inflation. Their job is to create inflation. But at one time, theoretically, their job was to fight inflation. Now their job is to create it. That's the kind of world that we're living in. Meanwhile, this idea that people will, not buy things if they think they can get them cheaper in the future, an easy way to refute that is look at the use of credit cards. How many people in America that can't afford something buy it anyway by using a credit card? Because when they do that, they add about 10 or 15 or 20% to the cost because they have to pay the interest. So if they really were so concerned about saving money, they wouldn't use their credit cards. They would just wait until they had the money and then buy the goods a year or two later. We all want low prices. The only people who don't want low prices are debtors. See, because if debtors have borrowed a lot of money, they want inflation. They want to be able to pay back the money they borrowed with inflated dollars. So if you've borrowed a lot of money, then yes, a lot of inflation will help you out. But it's not a coincidence, who is the biggest debtor of them all? Who's borrowed more money than anybody on the planet? The government. So that's why the government wants inflation. Of course, the government is also pinning its economic hopes on asset bubbles, the wealth effect, rising stock prices, rising real estate prices. They need inflation to sustain that. So because the government wants to keep inflating the bubbles, because the government wants to inflate away its debts, right, that's why it needs inflation. Another reason they need inflation is to lower the minimum wage. They impose the minimum wage, which creates unemployment because it prices unskilled laborers out of the market, And what they do is they create inflation to reduce the value of wages so that employers could afford to hire the people that the minimum wage law made unemployable. So it's like a government bailout.
Well, you also point out that the mainline thinking promotes inflation, you know, to keep, as you mentioned, unemployment low. But that this is really an illusion. If prices were allowed to fall to their equilibrium level, workers would have more disposable income. And then that income would be spent on goods and services, and this would help right the economy. Wouldn't this reduce the magnitude and regularity of our economic downturns, Peter?
We wouldn't even have economic downturns if the government wasn't manipulating the money supply. You know, the business cycle is a byproduct of government manipulation. It's the monetary policy that's behind it. But if we really want true prosperity that raises the standard of living of the poorest among us and the middle class, we need capitalism. We need to go back to what worked in the 19th century, which is limited government, freedom, free enterprise, sound money, limited government, which means no taxes or very low taxes, certainly no income taxes or payroll taxes. We want taxes that don't do economic harm. Sales taxes, for example, you know, import taxes, stuff like that. Taxes that you can pay without thinking about it. Taxes where you don't need financial planning, where you don't need accountants and lawyers, you know, and, you know, stuff like that. And where the government doesn't need an army of tax collectors and tax preparers. You know, we got to eliminate the entire industry of financial planning. It is a waste. It is a waste of our resources to try to figure out how to protect our money from government theft.
Now, you also offer a panacea, though, for inflation. You say that legislators should implement a balanced budget. You've talked about the Fed, but you haven't mentioned the balanced budget to avoid debt there. What do you think?
Yeah, well, if the Fed wasn't monetizing the debt, we would have a balanced budget because interest rates would be too high. The government couldn't afford to borrow. So the government and the Federal Reserve are working hand in hand to rob Americans blind. But those of us, you know, there are people who say we need inflation because governments have all this debt, and so inflation will ease that burden. Yes, but the solution isn't to create inflation to wipe out government debt. The solution is for governments not to go into debt in the first place, and then they won't need inflation to wipe it out.
Moving on to the precious metal sector, you know, so far this year, it's up by about 5%, but the media is once again bashing the metals. They're discussing the rally only in terms of last year's reaction. It looks like they're missing the significant fact that the bottom might be in place here.
Yeah, everybody wants to talk about how last year was the worst year for gold in 20 or 30 years, and that this is just a dead cat bounce. You know, the only reason that gold sold off so hard in the second half of 2013 was because so many people jumped to the wrong conclusion at the same time. The Fed said that they were going to end QE, and a bunch of people believed it. They actually believed that the Fed could not only stop buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, but it could actually start selling the ones that it already owns, and somehow it could do that without spiking interest rates and collapsing the economy, which is a fantasy. It can't be done. So the people who sold gold did it based on a false premise. But they all did it at the same time. And you had years and years of buying liquidated in a matter of months, and so the price dropped. But I think all of the gold that the speculators unloaded in the second half of 2013 has been bought by entities that have no intention of ever selling it. Once the market turns around, and I think it's, you know, it probably has already bottomed, and we're surprising everybody with the rally thus far in 2014, which I think will gather momentum as the year progresses, especially when we get more of the economic data coming out this spring, which does not show an improvement over the winter, in fact, which may even continue to deteriorate because everybody has been dismissing all the bad news as if it was solely related to the cold weather. But when they realize that it wasn't the weather, it was that the economy was legitimately slowing down and the weather was a minimal, if any, factor, then more and more people are going to realize that the Fed is not going to end QE, that they're going to halt the taper and, in fact, reverse course, which I think they will do before the end of the year in an attempt to avoid recession or stimulate the economy or prop up the sagging stock and real estate markets. Then I think gold takes off. And a lot of people who sold it are going to want to buy it back. The problem is going to be, where are they going to get the metal?
speaking of where they're going to get the metal, you talk about the Street Tracks Gold ETF, GLD reversing course, accumulating significant bullion in its stockpile. You know, it's not the only ETF out there. There are numerous gold ETFs around the world.
Oh, yeah.
They've got to buy back the gold they've sold off. And if China absorbed in Asia, that is, the Asian nations, absorbed much of that stockpile, I mean, this could be a huge impetus sending the metals higher.
Who really has to buy it back? The shorts. There are a lot of short sellers in this market. They got into the market late last year. In fact, I remember watching, you know, television on CNBC. They'd bring up a portfolio manager, and they'd ask them, well, what are you doing? And almost everybody was saying, well, we're short gold. And I had never, in all my years, heard so many people who have probably never traded gold come out and confess that they're now short. Because everybody believed that it was a free trade, that it was a no-brainer, that if you shorted gold, you'd make 20 or 30% because it was going to collapse, you know, for sure. And now they're all stuck in this trade. They're all losing. They're on the wrong side of the market. They're hoping that things turn around. But at some point, as the price goes higher and higher and higher, and they can't endure the pain anymore, they're going to be forced to cover these short positions. And when the shorts look to cover, again, who are they going to buy from when they've been supplying the metal to the market? It's the shorts that have been enabling people to buy gold, except they've been selling gold that they don't even own.
Well, you compare gold to the price of Dow, you know, the equities index, and you see, in order for it to get back to its historical average, either gold must move higher or the Dow must decline sharply, and you seem to think that both will occur. Will investors roll their stock gains into the precious metals?
Yeah, well, I don't know how much the Dow is going to decline. So I think most of that is going to be made up with gold prices going up, right? I mean, not so much the Dow going down, because I do believe that they'll print enough money to put a floor beneath the stock market. So I don't think, you know, they're going to meet at 2,000 or 3,000, right? I think they're going to meet at a much higher level. By the time they're 1-to-1 again, it'll probably be with gold, you know, with a Dow, you know, 5,000 to 10,000, if not higher. So I'm not looking for a collapse in the Dow, but I, you know, the Dow could certainly move down. The Nasdaq, I think, is the most vulnerable there, because there you have, you know, so much hype and so much fluff in the stocks that are in that index. So there's more downside for these, you know, momentum pie in the sky, no earnings, you know, all sizzle, no steak type stocks. But, you know, people just should be buying gold. The gold stocks, I think, are, you know, for people who really want to, you know, swing for the fences, there is tremendous upside in the mining stocks, because they're priced for, you know, collapsed gold prices. You know, when gold prices don't collapse, when they in fact go way up, these assets have to be totally repriced, because they have to be looked at in a totally different light.
Oh, yeah. No, as a sector, I mean, we're talking about very fairly valued price-to-earnings ratios. You know, take a look at, like, Netflix, Google, Apple, and many others. I mean, they're priced for perfection, and we're starting to see the fallout there. So,
I mean, I looked through my own portfolio, and about, you know, just about the only stocks that I have, you know, that are lower than I paid for them are gold stocks. You know, so all the other stocks I have gone up, and some of my gold stocks have gone up. They're the best values.
You also question whether or not the Fed can sustain the asset bubbles if it simply supplies enough air in the form of freshly minted QE cash and zero interest rates. Could the economy be moving from too big to fail into the realm of too big to bail?
It is too big to bail, and that's why I think the Fed thinks the bubbles are too big to pop. That's why they want to keep them inflated, but they can't do it forever. They can't keep printing money without collapsing the dollar, and I think that's the real collateral damage. The Fed will keep printing money to keep the bond market propped up, to keep the equity markets and the housing market propped up, to keep the government in business, to enable them to keep borrowing and spending. So they'll keep printing and printing and printing until the bottom drops out of the dollar, which will happen eventually. It should have already happened. But, you know, the world has a lot more confidence in our money than they should. But, you know, eventually, you know, they won't. And the confidence will fail. And that's the crisis that we're heading to. And that's the one that people need to be prepared for. What we needed was lower housing prices. But what we got was a reflated bubble where you have hedge funds and private equity guys speculating in the single-family home market. You have home ownership rates plunging to 20- and 30-year lows as hedge funds are leveraged up with empty houses. So the government has reflated a bubble that will burst, you know, as interest rates rise and when these hedge funds look to unload these properties that they can't rent out. Meanwhile, nobody can afford to buy them either. So, look, we're perched on a very precarious ledge, and they're going to just keep printing money because they're afraid of stopping. And I think it's all a bluff, and I don't even know if the Fed believes what they're saying with respect to being able to stop the QE. Maybe they don't. Maybe they believe it. Maybe they're just pretending. But they're going to stop. The data is going to come out, and it's going to be too negative, and the Fed's going to be going to have to do something, and they're going to do what they do, which is print money. Even though it doesn't work, that's the only tool in their shed. In their box, right? So they'll keep using it.
No, I can confirm everything you've said. You know, industry insiders here on the show in the housing sector claim that the, as you say, hedge funds, and not just hedge funds, many of these other entities that are gobbling up the McMansion debt checks, they plan to dump those on the market as soon as they move a bit higher and rates start to ratchet up.
Sell to who? There's no one to sell to. They're the main buyers. They can't turn around and sell. It's just like the Fed. The Fed has got all these bonds and mortgage-backed securities. It's got a $4 trillion balance sheet, and people think they can turn around and become a seller.
Well, maybe the government will buy it up, and they'll sell us back our homes.
Remind your listeners that the new version of the real crash just came out last week. That's the real crash, America's coming bankruptcy, how to save yourself and your future and your country. Right? It's got over 100 new pages, so it's 444 pages now. It's the brand new, fully revised and updated version of the real crash. So pick up a copy. Even if you read the original, it's worth buying a new one to get the extra 100 pages. And don't forget, I'm doing my own radio show, the Peter Schiff Show, every weekday from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time. Schiffradio.com is the URL. You can listen live, or in fact, you can go to that website any time of day and listen to the most recent show for free.
We're going to have links to both on the webpage today.
Thank you.
Dennis Miller consults with Fortune 500 companies, and he's trained hundreds of executives at GE, Mobile, Shell, Schlumberger, HP, IBM, and many more. He recently penned Retirement Reboot and has a monthly newsletter, Money Forever, and his free journal, Miller's Money Weekly, to help folks prepare a safe retirement portfolio for his subscribers. And you know, as many as 500,000 baby boomers are retiring each month. This trend is going to persist for years to come. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, Mr. Miller.
Chris, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
In your service, Miller's Money, you show subscribers how to avoid catastrophic losses in your model portfolio, and you've recently added some interesting high-yield bond funds to the portfolio. I wonder if you could outline how these higher yields are worth the additional risk that can accompany them. Maybe you could tell people just what inspired your decision.
Well, that's a good question. You got the tough one right off the bat. I want to share with you a quick story. A few months ago, I was a guest at a presentation by the head of the bond department of a major brokerage firm. Now, I'm soon to be 74 years old, and let's just say I was with my peer group in the audience, okay? He went through this presentation, and the gist of his presentation was he was talking about, you know, the high-quality AAA, AA-rated corporate bonds, you know, the solid citizens, the utility bonds. And what he suggested was, so that you can get some higher rates, that these folks, and for argument's sake, you had $80,000, you ladder them over 8 years so that you'd go into $10,000 a year. And then each year when one matures, you buy another one that's 8 years out. And that was his approach, for safety and getting higher yield. Now, I looked at that, and it was interesting because one of the participants raised the question about inflation. And he said, well, right now the government reported inflation is around 2%, and it seems to be under control. Then he also said something to the, if you believe inflation is under control, I'll tell you something that happened to me recently. I took my daughter and her husband and two grandchildren to the ballpark. Take a family to the ballpark and buy them lunch and tell me inflation is 2%. But anyway, somebody also asked about the higher yielding junk bonds. And his comment was, well, they don't call them junk bonds for nothing. You have to be very selective with it, but they're can be money made doing that. And he says, we've actually put together some portfolios where we'd never in our history have our investors lost money. Now, my first reaction to that was, not losing money is a good place to start, but we have a little higher goal than that. So I didn't say anything, and I got home, and I went on their website. And if you were to follow that philosophy of buying top-quality bonds, ladder them out over 8 years, average interest rate would be less than 2%, because that's just what the market is paying. And I'm sitting there saying, you and I both have our feelings about inflation versus what the government reports. Certainly anybody that is listening to goldteeth.com is very aware of the inflation and the problems it can pose for us. And I said, why would we go into an investment and tie up our money for as long as 8 years when we know by the time we pay taxes we're going to end up with less buying power than we got started? So I came back to our analyst team, and basically we all came to the same conclusion. A lot of consumers, when they talk to their broker or talk to their bond person, they talk about safety. And what they don't understand is, while they're talking about safety from default, there are a lot of other risks that are come into the picture when you're buying bonds, and they need to be factored into the equation. AAA bonds are safe, but they don't protect you from everything.
There's so many issues that surround bonds. I guess we could look at this from either perspective. We could look at it as they're, in general, much safer than the typical equity because the debt holder and the stakeholder has first priority in the event of a bankruptcy over shareholders and equity holders. But there's so many other interesting aspects of this story that I know we're going to delve into later on in this discussion. So let's move on to another question. In the wake of the 2008 credit crisis, the preponderance of study findings show that a primary culprit behind the economic implosion was the incentive system where the top ratings agencies such as Fitch, S&P, Moody's, and others are paid by the bond issuers, which creates a form of what I call anti-transparency where bond issuers shop around for the best rating. Can you help alleviate some of our listeners' concerns about the foxes who appear to be guarding the bond investment rating henhouse?
Well, that's an interesting question you asked because, you know, I get asked a lot of times about just something basic. Explain what the bond ratings are. And as you well know, there's only two different, or there's two major firms. There's Moody's and Standard & Poor's that assign a rating to the bond issues. Now, I explain the bond rating as like a personal credit score. You know, every one of us has a credit score. So somebody goes in and they apply for an auto loan. If they got a credit score in the 800s versus somebody who wants to borrow the same amount of money on the same auto that might have a credit score in the 600s, the fact is the person with a higher credit score is going to be charged a lower amount of interest. So the incentive system from the borrower is, of course, they're going to find the one that's going to give them the best rating because they're going to save millions and millions of dollars in interest based on that rating because that rating reflects the interest that they have to pay to borrow other people's money. Now, the fact that there was some apparent hanky-panky going on should not have been a surprise to most people. So we just like to talk about it as a general rule. And, you know, as a general rule, if you go back, you have to look at the historical default rate. And a historical default rate using the S&P is like, these are capital letters. Instead of using numbers, they go AAA, which is capitals, and they go down to a D, which is in default, and then some of them are small letters versus capital. But as a general rule, down to BBB with capital Bs, the historical default rate is pretty close to zero. So that's the way we have to go back and look at it and say, forgetting their ratings, let's look at the historical default rate, and then we'll pick the default rate that we are comfortable with relative to the interest rates. Now, then you start go down to D. Well, they're already in default. But between that, the triple B, and down to the C, which is you're starting to be concerned about default, there's a sweet spot in there where you still have good quality companies. Yes, you might have a little higher default rate, but the interest rate that you earn as commensurate with your risk makes it worth it. Otherwise, banks wouldn't lend money to people with credit scores in the 600. Well, the reason they do it is they charge them more interest, and that additional interest offsets some of their losses. So my point is, I'm not as inclined to worry so much about the rating of the individual bond. I'm going to look at it more as the historical default rate and whether the bond rating agencies were incentivized to rate them high or low. The historical default rate tells the story.
You know, I would underscore the significance of what you've just outlined. It really is the historical default that gives investors, I think, that peace of mind and perspective. Extrapolate forward just what they should expect. And as you say, this is such an infinitesimally small figure. It gives, I think, investors the confidence to sleep well at night. And I'd like to move on to another point here. You know, bonds typically carry less risk than equities, and we've already addressed some of the reasons why, entitled to bankruptcy proceedings in advance of equities. But less well-understood risks include inflation. Since the bond price is inversely related, of course, or correlated with the current interest rate, inflation erodes not only the principal, but of course the present value of future cash flows, known as coupon payments. This is what our listeners might think of as dividends with stocks, but we have coupons with bonds. Now, there is some risk associated with opportunity cost, and using the capital asset pricing model, the CAPM, as our guide, you know, the expected return on bonds is well below that of stocks. I wonder if you could outline the risks, including the opportunity cost associated with bond investing, please.
You know, within our Miller's Money, we have a model portfolio. And we are showing folks that are thinking about retiring or retiring how to invest money to stay ahead of inflation, to supplement their Social Security, and keep those risks to a minimum. So that while you talked about bonds in relation to stock, on the stock side, you have to surgically protect pick your stocks, diversification, stop losses. We're not going to go there for today's discussion. But we don't recommend going all in there because every retiree's portfolio should be limited on that because, you know, we saw what's happened at Amazon. You know, you want to get the high flyers on the way up. But the reality is, look what happened in 2008 where some people that I know took a 40 to 50% hit in their portfolio. So you want to talk about risk. The market right now is at an all-time high. And the risk of a tumbling are significant. So that you've got to burn the candle at both ends, and you've got to put some money into fixed income. But when you talk about the risk of the fixed income, bonds definitely have a place in your portfolio. And you talked about the difference between interest rates. Let me give you an example of one I wrote about recently in an article, and you'll find this on our millersmoney.com website. We took two Guggenheim bond funds. Both of these, this is exchange-traded funds, have maturity dates, target maturity dates in 2018. Now, one of them, the symbol is BSCI. It's a top-quality corporate bond fund. It's currently paying a 2.2% yield. Now, their other fund is called BSJI, and these are the higher-yielding, higher-risk bonds, and they're lower-rated, and it's paying 4.9% interest, over double what the first fund pays. So when you want to look at risk, you can look at the rating, but you can also say, what's the default rate on the lower-risk bonds? Because I know if I go into a fund paying me 2.2% interest, particularly if it's in a taxable account, when that bond matures, I have less buying power than when I started. At least with the 4.9%, And we'll talk a little bit later about how to decide which funds you go in and some steps you want to take. You have a shot at least keeping up with inflation and having a little bit of money left over. So the risk has to be the balance between the two. Where inflation really comes in, and Chris, I have to believe that your GoldSeek listeners probably will understand this better than most. We took a situation during the Jimmy Carter years, and we said, okay, let's suppose investor A buys a $100,000, 5%, five-year certificate of deposit, right in the Carter years before they went into high inflation. And we said, to keep it a simple illustration, so he buys this, and let's say that one of his favorite cars, a Ford, was $25,000 a piece. So basically, he took the money that he could buy four $25,000 Fords and lent it to the bank. So 5 years later, he has all his money back, plus he has all his interest. But when you factored in the double-digit inflation, which a lot of people believe is on our horizon, that they had in the Carter years, he actually lost 25.9%, I believe it was, of his buying power. In other words, at the end of 5 years, you apply that same inflation to the price of the Ford. Now he can only buy three Fords and have a little gas money left over. And then when you use inflation, one of the biggest challenges we have as newsletter writers is to try to get the audience to understand that you might have more money in the end of your account when that bond or that CD matures. But if it buys less than when you started, you've taken a major, major hit.
Of course, we're referring to purchasing power here, and we're also talking about the expected return of your portfolio. For instance, let's say we earn 5% over the next 5 years, but if inflation, true inflation, in the neighborhood of 6%, we actually have lost purchasing power. We feel richer, that is, until we go shopping, or we try to purchase a home, or we pay our bills. I'd like to also underscore this Guggenheim BulletShares 2018 High Yield Corporate Bond ETF. This is my favorite of the two you've picked. Took a long look at both companies, and the holdings on both of these are solid. These are not fly-by-night junk bonds. In fact, I don't think they've earned that moniker. I prefer high yield. It's so well diversified that I think our listeners will have some peace of mind here. Any portfolio would benefit.
You've done something, though, that I think your listeners need to understand, because when we are looking at bonds and we have some of the Guggenheim funds in our model portfolio, we have to look at it in combination of interest rates, default, and also we are strong believers that you should hold the bonds to maturity. We're not traders here. We're looking for yield. But there is also a third thing called the resale value. It's called effective duration. Oddly enough, those two Guggenheim funds, if the interest rate drop, the higher yield fund will not drop as much as far as resale value goes. I don't want to dwell on it a lot because realistically, you want to hold them to maturity. You just don't want to have to hold them for 5 or 6 years at below market interest rate. But what we suggest is exactly what you outlined, and I really want your listeners to understand it. When you get something like the prospectus for that Guggenheim fund, do as Chris suggested. Look at their holdings. We look at it from so many different perspectives. For example, our analyst team has got a real axe to grind as far as financials are concerned. They really don't want a whole lot of, in the financial sector. I've got a real axe to grind because I grew up in Chicago, and I see what's happening in Michigan, and I see what's happening in Illinois. So you're looking at diversification, good companies among sectors, geographically, and you have to take a look at it. And the second part is I don't want any holding in that fund any more than 1% to 2% of the total amount of the fund. So if it does default, it's not a catastrophic event for you. And is it worth the almost double the rate of the safer corporate bond fund? I'm with you. Once you've done your homework and you've vetted it, I think for the next 3 or 4 years, that's a good place to go, because you have a better shot at staying ahead of inflation. And, yeah, your default rate is going to be a little higher, but your net gain is still going to be better.
Key ratios that need to be examined in some of those holdings. For instance, I really like to bullet down into the interest coverage of the companies behind the debt. Let's take Chrysler, for instance. I like to look at their interest coverage, make sure they're not having or going to have any difficulty covering debt. And I also like to take a look at the debt to equity ratio, give folks an idea of just how much debt have they taken on, which could perhaps sink the Titanic. I wonder if you could tell subscribers and listeners, what are you telling your subscribers today is the right track for their investment portfolio?
That's a good one. I think what I'd like to do, you talked about ratios, is we've put together a model portfolio. And this model portfolio is for anyone who is investing money that they have to have for retirement. Now, we have surgically picked some well-diversified portfolio of stocks, and you know, many of them now were into nice double-digit gains and nice dividends on top and all the things you would expect to do by picking the right stocks in a rising market. Now, with that being said, diversification is still the holy grail of safety. So on the stock side, we recommend no more than 5% of your overall portfolio in any single issue. I don't care how hot it is, how much you think it's going to be, you know, the next Amazon or Google or whatever it is. And then we will put in a 20% trailing stop loss. Now, Chris, you can go through the math and say, what's the worst case scenario? The worst case scenario is you'd lose 1% on your investment if you got stopped out, 1% meaning of your overall portfolio. Well, if you only have 50% of your portfolio in there, okay, then in effect you're talking about losing maybe 10 stocks at 5%, so you could max lose 10% overall if Armageddon took place. A lot of people in the crash in 2007 or 2008 would have been delighted to only have had 10% losses. Now, when we go to the bond side, we also recommend a position in to fixed income. But here is what we're having to deal with, and that is what we're having to deal with is the inflation factor. Why would anybody buy a 10-year, I don't care how solid it is, certificate deposit or anything else when the interest rate is guaranteed not to keep up with inflation? So what we've had to do was, and I can share these with you, you know, our subscribers pay us for our picks, and we can't divulge them until we've had them in our portfolio for over 30 days. But right now, we've got in our portfolio, the Guggenheim, and the symbol is BSJF and BSJG, which is the 2015 and 2016 version of the fund that we talked about earlier. And like I started at the beginning where the gentleman was talking about laddering out over 8 years, our feeling is these are not necessarily going to be the greatest inflation fighters in the world, but at least you have a better shot of staying ahead. And you can go out, like you said, to that 2018 fund. But I would say to somebody, if you had $40,000, I'd go 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018. And then when you get around to the first quarter of 2015, sell that and go out to 2019. So ladder those high-yield funds in no more than four-year ladders. And that's going to give you a pretty good bit of safety. And on that fixed income side of your portfolio, you're going to get some yields that at least should be able to keep you up with, if not beat inflation. You've got to diversify it. You cannot be all in bonds. You cannot be all in the stock market. And Lord knows anybody who's sitting all in cash is in trouble. And part of that portfolio better have some gold and silver and some other big inflation hedges. It's all got to fit together.
I like the sound of that. You're talking about diversifying even market risk away, and so few analysts and financial prognosticators seem to grasp the significance of that. All you have to do is go back to a chart of 2008, and you can superimpose bonds with stocks, and then, let's say, stocks with gold, and you start to realize that when the difficult times come, you need a component of your portfolio to compensate for the wild gyrations that we have experienced in our markets in the past 10 years in particular. And I think you'd probably concur with the notion that we should expect significant volatility in these markets.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And let me talk to the baby boomers out there for a minute. There are several differences today in 2014 than we had even 10 years ago. And that is our biological clock is ticking. You know, we're sitting here at the market now at an all-time high. It crashed 7 years ago in round numbers. The crashes that we have seen in our lifetime and the recoveries have all taken 5 to 7 years. Chris, the graph that really scares me is the 1929 graph, because it took 25 years before the market came back. Now, can you guarantee me, with the things that we're seeing now, with the Federal Reserve printing a 100-year supply of money every year for the last 4 to 5 years, that if we have another crash, that it's going to come back in 4 to 5 years as opposed to 25? As a guy who is retired and working with a lot of baby boomers who are concerned about it, their biological clock doesn't allow them to risk something that may or may not come back in 7 to 25 years.
We have to have contingency plans in place. It's so ironic that people don't think even twice about having insurance on their automobile, insurance on the greatest investment they thought of their life, which was their home, but they forget all about their retirement funds. And once again, just take a look at 2008, see how bond funds exploded in value as stocks imploded in value. It's just another tool to secure your family's future and your retirement. I wonder if you could tell us about just how well this has performed. As I understand, we're looking at, on average, over 24%. That was at the March issue, giving folks a really solid start on their retirement. When you factor in all of the aspects, this looks like a wonderful opportunity for people. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more as we wrap up our discussion today, please.
Yeah, well, we followed your model, and that is you've got to burn the candle at both ends between the stock market and bonds and fixed income and cash and gold and silver. It's the combination that a lot of people struggle with from a safety perspective. So if the market tanks, we still are covered here. If interest rates are a little lower, we'll get it from the market. Right now, the 50% of our portfolio that we have in the market, I believe the number in March, and I don't have it right in front of me, we were averaging something like a 20% gain or something like that. So the portfolio side of the market that is, the portfolio side rather we have in the market is doing very, very well. And it is well diversified geographically and among sectors. So that half of the portfolio is going to keep any retiree ahead of inflation and throwing off some supplemental income to add to their Social Security. Then the other half we have in the secure, safer fixed income side, like the Guggenheim funds and things like that. And what we're looking for is what we talked about today. Safe things that if the market drops like a rock, we're still getting a good yield here, and they are, you know, keeping us in the game so that the net effect of the entire portfolio is giving our subscribers enough of a yield to stay ahead of inflation, make sure that their buying power at the end of the year is a lot more than it was in the beginning of the year. But unlike when we were working full-time, we can also tap into it and take some of that money as we need it to pay the bills. And so far, we've done very well, as I said, with the double-digit yield, and stack that up with the safety that we have, we're very, very comfortable with it. If the market crashes, sure, we're going to take a hit. But we'll be well ahead of most, unlike what happened in 2008.
I think it's well said. And, you know, as we were talking before the show, folks just really want to buy the sizzle. It's difficult to focus on the risk side of the equation when the return is making the headline news every day. Higher highs in the equities market. Tesla is on fire. Oh, Netflix is the next Apple or the next Microsoft. It's very difficult to keep one's mind focused there. But, you know, if suddenly we do enter even just 2008, not even 1929, where you lost 89%, almost 90% from peak to trough, but if we did enter 2008-like conditions once again, losing 50% of my portfolio is going to require a 100% return just to get back to break even. But you know, if I'd had a nice solid core holding in these bonds, more than likely most of that loss would have been offset and I would have been earning a yield all during that time.
As well as the stop losses on the stock side, so that you don't take 50%, because I want to go one step further. If we had another 2008 crash today, tell me what tools the Federal Reserve has to bail us out another time. They've already taken interest rates down to what they call negative rates, meaning they're not keeping up with inflation. They don't have any ammunition left in their arsenal if it happens again.
It's so well said. I mean, what are they going to come up with, a derivative of quantitative easing? We've already lost our AAA status, at least according to one ratings agency. I believe it's S&P. We're starting to run out of ammunition at the Federal Reserve. Their options are limited. Imagine if they had to backtrack now after just starting this tapering program that's supposed to wrap up sometime by the end of this year or early next year, where they hypothetically claim they're going to raise interest rates. That will be quite interesting. I think you'd see the nascent housing recovery implode if mortgage rates started to ratchet up even a few percent. So it's interesting times ahead, and that's why I think this information today is so salient. We have to keep the risk side of the equation in focus. All right, Dennis Miller, we want to thank you today for an enlightening and information-packed discussion. Any other contact information for our listeners or anything else on your radar screen, sir?
Last week, I wrote an article about the concept behind the bonds and talking about the bond funds that we talked about. So if any of them want further information, they can go to the website and they can find some articles on that. And if they want to, you know, go into being paid subscribers, which is $99 a year, so it's not going to break anybody's bank, we've actually got some special reports where we have written a special report that's got a lot of play, and it's part of the subscription called Bond Basics. And if anybody is interested in going into bonds, the feedback we've got from that is one of the best primers going. So if they want further information, they can go to your website. You'll show them all the way to find us. And we really are focusing now on bonds just as much as we are stocks.
You know, we'll take it a step further. We're actually going to include this contact information for all of my subscribers via email. So you will receive this in your email box and you can just make a convenient click there, whether it be through your mobile phone or at your desktop or laptop computers. Dennis Miller, we want to thank you for joining us today. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Several months ago, I did a commentary discussing the timing of the next major slide in the housing market would be toward the third quarter of 2014 or early in 2015. It's starting, and it's starting to be noticed. The real estate show I listen to while running errands each weekend in Nevada just announced that demand has slid 20% and inventory is up 50%, and it's going to get worse. According to a CNBC interview with Realty Track this week, the pool of underwater borrowers, classified as seriously underwater, peaked at 12.8 million, which was 29% of all properties with a mortgage in the second quarter of 2012. Rising prices over the past year have apparently pushed some of those homeowners back above water. RealtyTrack says during the first quarter of 2014, 9.1 million homes, or 17% of homes with mortgages, were seriously underwater, which means owing at least 25% more than the property's estimated market value. Right now, certain areas of the U.S. are still suffering badly. In Fresno and Stockton, California, some homeowners are still 20 to 40% underwater. In Nevada, 34% of homeowners remain underwater. In Florida, 31%. In Illinois, 30%. In Michigan, 29%. In Ohio, 27%. And the list goes on. The myth of a recovering economy is just that, a myth. And now, with local media beginning to report that demand is slipping and inventories are rising, indicates a trend that has been acknowledged on this broadcast for quite some time, but once again is now only beginning to seep its way into the national consciousness. Once again, it will be too late for most. The trend is clear. Rising inventories, slipping demand, and over time, higher interest rates. Millions of homeowners can still lose their home to short sales. In markets where prices are appreciating, banks are waiting for properties to appreciate and then foreclosing on homeowners who are behind on their payments. If you live in or are visiting a troubled real estate market like Nevada, California, Florida, Michigan, or any other, I encourage you to listen to the local real estate weekend shows hosted by local attorneys. They are entertaining and give you an early warning signal of what the national media is often weeks or months behind in reporting. People are beginning to realize the dead cat bounce in rising home values the past 2 years were not a trend of sustainability. They were not representative of an expanding or recovering economy as sold to us by statistically illiterate elected officials whose only objective was re-election. They were the result of an end to low interest rates and a reversal of institutional investors from buyer to seller status in the residential housing market. The housing crisis never ended. We are headed into our 7th year of it. And while it may have gone off some people's radar screens the past 2 years, it has always been there. And later this year, and especially next year, it will resume its rightful place, center stage, in the next chapter of the U.S. financial crisis. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.